I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University in a conversational series with poets whose words these are. In the run-up to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival in October 2009, the question came, where does poetry come from these days? And where is it going? Jill McDonough of Boston embodies a lot of answers here. A big, energetic presence. She can be funny in a dark way and dark in a funny way. She's a teacher of university students at Harvard, also in state prison. Her first collection in print is 50 poems about people executed in America from the 17th century to Timothy McVeigh in 2001. That book called Habeas Corpus makes clear, as the writer Wendy Lesser put it, that Jill McDonough has mastered two things, the sonnet form and a particularly ugly facet of American history. In the late summer of 2009, Jill McDonough talked with us and read for us at the Grolier Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square. Jill McDonough, start at the beginning, your beginning. There must have been a poem or a poet that called out to you.
When I was in high school, I was forced to memorize Sonnet 18 by William Shakespeare, and that getting that music in my head was important. And
Remind us of Sonnet 18.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day, though I'm more lovely? So I force students to memorize those all the time, and I force them to write iambic pentameter. I think it makes them better writers. But I brought with me Anna Van Bolen Quarantine.
Who is Van Bolen?
Van Bolen, Irish poet, teaches at Stanford now, runs their creative writing program. And this is a more recent poem, but I think it's useful and important in understanding how political writing can be accomplished.
Please.
Right. Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking, north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847. Also what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and a woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved.
Merciless inventory.
Yeah, that sticks out for me a lot, too. It's Carolyn Frechet, too, talks about the poetry of witness, and that I think the mercilessness and the inventory are both important if you're looking at something to praise about what poetry can accomplish.
It's so powerful, and I don't know the poem, but it's Irish, it's political, it's loving, it's...
You know it now.
Is that the test?
No, that's how we get to know stuff.
Would you give us another from sort of your all-time inventory?
Yeah.
Your all-time merciless inventory?
My all-time merciless inventory. Here's the similar poetry of witness, but particularly American in the way that it's the whole world. This is Robert Pinsky's Shirt. The back, the yoke, the yardage, lapped seams, the nearly invisible stitches along the collar turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians, gossiping over tea and noodles on their break, or talking money, or politics, while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band of cuff I button at my wrist. The presser, the cutter, the ringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the treadle, the bobbin, the code. The infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the ninth floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. The witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop. And then another. As if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar and not eternity. A third, before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once he stepped up to the sill himself. His jacket flared and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar-tacked corners of both pockets, like a strict rhyme or a major chord. Prints, plaids, checks, houndstooth, Tattersall, Madras. The clan tartans invented by mill owners, inspired by the hoax of Ossian, to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry, MacGregor, Bailey, McMartin. The kilt, devised for workers to wear among the dusty, clattering looms. Weavers, carters, spinners, the loader, the docker, the navvy, the planter, the picker, the sorter sweating at her machine in a litter of cotton, as slaves in calico head rags sweated in fields. George Herbert, your descendant is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt. Its color and fit and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone. The buttonholes, the sizing, the facing, the characters printed in black on neckband and tail. The shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade. The shirt.
Wow. Lists and feeling.
Litany. Yeah, the power of that litany, that list. I'm with you. It's a terrific inventory.
You're also a poet of witness. Make the connections here with your own work.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the teaching that I've been doing in prison since 1999. The power of this work, the power of being able to look at something really square and pay attention to it, even when it's secret or hard to understand, is something that I wanted in my own poetry. And I was lucky enough to be invited to do some work in prisons through Boston University's prison education program. So I've gotten to work with hundreds of incarcerated college students and force them to write an iambic pentameter and talk about villanelles and make their own work stronger. And that, I think, the empathy that you have to have when you're in that situation is useful for helping you embody that kind of poetics that we're talking about.
Prison is such a fascinating zone of intense feeling and expressive need and all that sort of thing. What do you learn from the poets? And what do you learn from the prisoners?
Well, they are poets. They don't know it until you tell them. But if they take that poetry class, they get started and they do incredible stuff. I learn how much empathy and feeling they have for one another. It's incredible to watch these, often enormous, really tough guys break into tears and being so moved by each other's work. Being very supportive in an environment that has absolutely nothing to do with support. That kind of human interaction and bravery, the bravery to write the kind of stuff that they're writing in those circumstances. I think that courage is something I really take away from that teaching.
Mm. How does it connect with your other students and your other teaching?
I think no matter where you're teaching, you're always coming across, especially in creative writing, you're coming across students who are worried that they're no good, or, you know, I want you to look at this and tell me if it's any good. Should I keep writing? And all of them have this kind of insecurity and this uncertainty. And you just have to keep telling, you know, writers write and keep writing. And if it's something that's important to you, you're gonna be able to do it. You're already doing it. If you're writing poems, you're a poet. And kind of encouraging them to have that kind of faith in themselves, recognizing that whether you're at Harvard or you're in prison, there's a phrase, it's jail, not Yale. And they joke around about that a lot. But, you know, jail, Yale, we're all people. We're trying to make something, make art. We need as much support as we can get.
Jill, we're fascinated by your book, Habeas Corpus, your poems about executions in the last 500 years. Give us a taste and tell us how you settled on a whole book of poems death.
Yeah,
not just death, you know, execution.
My mom, when it came out, she was like, you know, honey, I didn't ever really think of you as goth. You know, are you okay? I don't think it's goth. I think it's American. You know, I love my country. And if you look square at this country, you see that we showed up and immediately started killing ourselves and each other.
And Mary Dyer twice. She makes two entries in your book.
Yep. She does. Shall we look at her first? Do you like her?
I love Mary Dyer.
I love Mary Dyer, too. I love that statue of her in the yard of the State House.
The Massachusetts State House. And a saint in Rhode Island, too.
Yeah. Beautiful statue. All right, there's two. I'll just go ahead and read them. October 22nd, 1659, Mary Dyer. Boston, Massachusetts. She walked between two men. All three bound to be hanged, the greatest joy and honor in this world for Quaker missionaries found in Boston. First, she watched them hang the men, hemp rope tossed over the limb of the elm. Then that noose around her neck, her arms bound tight behind her back, and Wilson's handkerchief tied loose over her face. Her homespun skirts were tied around her ankles after she climbed the rungs that they had climbed. A ladder, a hanging tree. No eye can see, no ear can hear, no tongue can speak her willingness to die. They freed her then, untied her, granted her reprieve. She heard, but could not move and would not leave. June 1st, 1660, Mary Dyer, Boston, Massachusetts. R. Iphigenia, released, alive, confused and disappointed. Her fellow Quakers stripped and buried on the spot. She was hauled in a fugue to jail, then to her son and husband. Ripped from destiny, she lived in Rhode Island till she came back to show us the guilt of our blood, and was hanged until dead from the elm on the common. Will, who works in the Athenaeum, shakes his head, says she was asking for it. Her unmarked grave is just outside the window, but it's still true. I rather choose to die than to live. You have no other weapons. Woe is me for you. Again, they bound her skirts and covered her face in Boston, the bitterest, darkest professing place. We killed her.
Jill McDonough, will you give us a kind of report to the ancestors on the state of poetry today in general? Who's doing it and who's connecting, who's reading it, who's doing it well?
Well, between the young writers that I meet in universities, I teach at UMass Boston, I teach at Harvard, I teach at BU, and the prisoners that I work with, not so young usually, but definitely young in their enthusiasm, they're desperate to get hold of a tradition, to lash themselves to it, to understand how to write in meter, to recognize form, to steep themselves in the history and see themselves as part of a trajectory, a continuation, a heritage. As soon as you give them those tools, they, you know, you set them loose and you can't believe what they can accomplish. Poetry is not just alive, it's thriving.
Out of curiosity, when you say give them the tools, what do you mean?
I force my students to learn iambic pentameter. I make them write in form. They have to use rhyme, and they have to write villanelles and write sonnets and write sestinas and really engage with those traditions, those forms, those formal elements. And then they have, if they chain themselves up, they're able to accomplish more than they can just loose with a blank page and a pencil.
Would you give us a sample of your student's work?
I will. We're going to call this guy Pete C. He wrote a villanelle called The Darkness of Night. All I can see is the darkness of night. As I look around, in a cabin are men packed tightly in. Glows a dim red light, the roar of engines around. I look out and see no ground. Surrounded by our thoughts in the night, glows a red light. With a sudden change, the light changes from red to green. All I see is the darkness of night as I look around. A voice shouts, "Soldiers, stand up, cable up, prepare to go." Facing the open door tells me it is my time to go. The roar of engines around, I look out and see no ground. A sudden rush of cold air. My senses tingle in the night as I silently fall into the night air, as I meet the darkness of night, as I look around. Suddenly I am jerked skyward, a fear finally relieved. Am I prepared for another fear of the night? The roar of engines around. I look down and see ground. While gliding in the air, I see flashes, first orange, then green, slicing through the air without any concern. All I see is the darkness of night. As I look around, the terror of these flashes leaping through the night, my chances grow slim. 4-1 seems pretty thin. The distant roar of engines. I am almost on the ground. My feet hit the ground. I roll around with flashes all around. The training is complete. The conflict has begun. I am facing the darkness of night as I look around. The roar of engines around. I am fighting on the ground.
Thank you, Pete C.
They are wonderful writers. Yeah. It's a real privilege to be able to work with them.
Any way to generalize about what people are writing about?
No, I don't think you could. I mean, there's a lot of people, I think, grappling right now with what it means to be American, especially over the last few years. I've had a lot of students struggling with ideas about torture. It's a bigger world now than I think it was for our parents, for our grandparents. And you see students, a poem is a terrific way of addressing a problem, of thinking through some thorny mess, and we are in plenty of thorny messes now. So those watching students work through those kinds of ideas with poetry is very satisfying.
Would you give us a taste of your own work in poetry on either of those, being American or torture?
I think this book is all about that. I mean, Habeas Corpus is a name that I chose. It's a book of that documents hundreds of years of the death penalty in America, but I think in its scope, it suggests also what has been happening, certainly during the Bush administration, and unfortunately continuing now, much to our chagrin. But that poetry of witness that examines those executions and those unpleasant truths is what being American is about. You know, recognizing that and taking responsibility for your part in that. Even just by looking at it, I think is a big part of what it means to be American.
Would you give us another one?
Yeah. June 11th, 2001. Timothy McVeigh. Terre Haute, Indiana. Victims, loved ones in Oklahoma City gathered to watch on closed circuit TV. Security kept hackers from stealing the signal. His lawyer said McVeigh was able to see the moon in the sky on the way to the death house, and that meant something to him. Viewers saw his face hard as stone, face of evil. His eyes looked black. He stared at the camera, jaw clenched, the face of hate. His eyes rolled back when his heart stopped and he died. Most saw the devil back in hell, which caused one man to say, "He's not a monster, guys. Not when you're looking him in the face." He paused. "There's no facial expressions on him, so there's no way of knowing exactly what he is." What's interesting in doing this research, seeing, you know, you start with things like hemp rope and hand-spun skirts, and then you've got hackers and closed-circuit TV. But within those trappings, while those trappings were different, the form of these executions and deaths was the same. You know, there's a trial, there's an execution, there are witnesses, there are last words, there's a kind of summary judgment, and then we move on to the next one.
Hmm. Come back to the community of poets today and the tradition. What are the degrees of separation with our history here?
I don't think there are any. There's no separation. There's a continuous line of people reading poetry, wanting to create it, admiring it so much that they seek to make their own, and trying to walk in those masters' footsteps. My prisoners being crazy about Elizabeth Bishop, my undergraduates being crazy about Whitman. There's no, you know, they're all tangled up for me. They're in there figuring it out for themselves.
Joe McGann, who do you write for? Are you writing for your students, other poets, yourself, for God, for history, for whom?
This book, I think, is for the dead. But it depends on who, on what the poem is. Like, I definitely, there are poems that I write for my friends, and there are poems that I write for my students, there are poems that I write for myself. It depends on what topic I'm engaged in. But when I, you know, when I wrote this book and there are sonnets that are each headed with the name and date of death of an individual, like that was for them, each of them, especially when I sought to quote them. I wanted to do these forgotten figures justice.
Mm. And then there's our version of the Proust questionnaire, half randomly trying to fill some personal gaps with Jill McDonough and all the poets we read and talk with. Who do you think of as your brother and sister artists in other mediums that you think of as kind of your colleagues?
Oh, colleagues is, you know, I was going to say Rothko, but you can't really claim Rothko as a colleague. Maybe mentor or parent or, I don't know, something like that. But those enormous paintings, those chapel paintings where you when you stand close enough, you can't tell if your eyes are open or closed. That kind of suspension and flooding, something that I'd like to be able to recreate that kind of sense of losing yourself.
What would you call the keynote of your personality as a poet?
Well, one thing that people tease me about a lot is that I like to think that I'm really funny, and it doesn't actually make sense for a funny person to write 50 sonnets about legal executions in American history. That's not funny. So I guess humor / empathy depends on which side of the street I'm walking on that day.
What's the talent you most covet that you don't have yet?
Boxing. I think I'd really like to be able to beat the hell out of somebody. I think that would be very satisfying.
What's your motto?
My motto? Writers write. I guess writers write. Students come to me and they ask if they're a writer. And I say, "Did you write something today?" Then, yeah, you're a writer. Relax.
What's the quality you love in a poem?
I think that saturation that we're talking about. You know, I was reading that the Pinsky poem and the Bolan poem to you, and I wasn't in the room anymore. You know, when you get to read that work out loud, you're embodying it so fully. You get to go away. You get to be someplace else. And certainly when I teach that work in prisons, they get that immediately. That is a magic ticket that they're so grateful for. But we all need that. You know, this is it's a dark time. There's a lot of really scary, depressing stuff going on. It's terrific to be able to open up a book and not be here for a while.
Expand on that notion that it's a dark moment.
Oh, I'm so disappointed in Obama. He wasn't promising much, but I still had this kind of misplaced faith that we were going to close Guantanamo and make sure that everybody was acting on the up and up and maybe get rid of Blackwater. And there's just a lot of stuff we're doing in the world stage that I'm really ashamed of. It's a hard time to be proud to be an American. I love my country.
Jill McDonough, thank you. Thank you for playing the game. Thank you for sharing this work.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with the poet Jill McDonough, whose first collection is called Habeas Corpus. You can link to more of her work and her life, also to more about the Massachusetts Poetry Festival, and you can leave your own take on poetry today at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation.